Welcome back to HealthLink On Air, produced each week by SUNY Upstate Medical University, making the academic difference in healthcare in the Central New York community. And this is your host, Tricia Torrey, Every Patient's Advocate. I'm joined this morning by Dr. Gregory Eastwood, Professor of Bioethics and Humanities, and Patricia Knox, Assistant Clinical Professor of Medicine and Nursing, Nurse Practitioner, and Director of Palliative Care, both from SUNY Upstate. And our topic is self-determination of end of life. Should we have the right to die at the time we wish? As we went to our break, we heard a passage from an article written by Jane Brody of the New York Times. She was thinking back to her experiences with two important people in her life who wanted to make that choice for themselves. Pat, are these the kinds of stories you hear in your role in palliative care?
Absolutely, Tricia. We are faced with these on a daily basis, given the fact that we have the technology to prolong people's lives today. So people are coming up with these questions and needing help and assistance to make decisions about what to do.
Well, you know, Dr. Eastwood, one of the questions that I've run into as I was researching for our conversation this morning is, what's the difference between self-determination and suicide, or even euthanasia? They're terms, but at what point do you run into them?
You know, these are terms, and frankly, it's a matter of definition. Suicide, we conventionally think of as taking our own lives, but under certain circumstances, medically speaking, one can take his or her own life, and it would not be at least legally regarded as suicide.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking specifically of what's happened recently in Washington State. They passed on November 4th in the general election a public referendum, that allows a new law to take into to go into effect soon. This law is virtually identical to the law that has existed since 1994 in Oregon.
Okay.
This law allows a person who is deemed to be within 6 months of death to take his or her own life using a prescription of deadly medication, lethal medication, prescribed by a physician. It's very important to note that the physician does not kill the patient in this, or does not participate in the act of administering the lethal medication, but the physician does prescribe the medication. There are safeguards in this law, as there is with the one in Oregon. The person must be an adult, that's defined as 18 or over, a resident of the state of Washington and their various means of determining that status. The person must be mentally competent, and this must be verified by two physicians. The patient must be terminally ill with at least 6 months to live, and that's an estimate by two physicians.
With at least or less than?
Less than. Thank you for verifying that.
Makes a difference.
Important difference. Less than 6 months to live. This must be voluntary, and this must be verified by two physicians. The patient must be informed of other options. There is a 15-day waiting period between the first oral request and a follow-up written request, and so on.
Now, is that the same, then, as what we might hear is called physician-assisted suicide? How, when you say physician-assisted, it sounds like the physician is actively doing something to help.
This is where we get into the matter of definition. Some would say the physician is assisting in this situation
by writing the prescription.
By writing the prescription, that's right. But what is conventionally meant by physician-assisted suicide is that the physician actually participates in the act of administering the medication.
You know, it brings to mind Jack Kevorkian, and I don't think we can have this conversation without mentioning him, and those contraptions that you would see pictures of on the TV news or in the newspaper that always looked a little science fictionish to me and very frightening, of course. And this is not that, is it?
This is not that. Jack Kevorkian, of course, served a role to bring this to the attention of our society. You can argue that that was a good role. You can argue that he overstepped the limit, but it certainly is not that contraption.
You know, the next question I have is whether there are levels in the right to die. And what I mean by that is we are asked to look at advanced directives, living wills, healthcare proxies, do not resuscitate orders, DNRs. And we're supposed to sign those in advance of our death so that at the time they are in place so determinations can be made. Is this just a question of levels, or is it maybe a question of proactive versus passive? What's the difference, Pat, between a DNR and then deciding 6 months before I'm supposed to die that I want to take my own life?
I think
besides time, of course.
I think the difference is that where you are physically and emotionally at that time, what the circumstances are in that situation. I think each and every circumstance is unique. I think to talk about doing an advance directive before you have any kind of time frame that says, yes, I have 6 months or less, is only a discussion and is part of a process. I think to have some discussion with your family and your healthcare proxy about what your wishes would be if and when the time comes, that how you define quality, what's important to you and how you want to engage in the end of life. So to do that is a process you started at the end. If I'm diagnosed and I'm told that I have 6 months or less, I'm going to then probably want to put more detail and more information into writing a do not resuscitate or a MOST.
And, you know, that raises an important question. Now you have a patient who may be making that determination for him or herself. What if the family disagrees? What if they get to that point and the family disagrees?
Well, this is not uncommon. In other words, it happens.
Yeah.
And I think it reinforces Pat's comments that it is better to have discussed these things in advance. Now, sometimes that's not possible with a large family or with family who have divergent views. And this is where the ethics consultation service in a hospital or a healthcare facility comes in. Sometimes it's very useful to have an ethics consultation to help sort these things out and convene the relevant people.
Sure, you have somebody who really is not emotionally engaged in the process, helping you make decisions. And you have a story to share with us, too, about a young man who this happened to.
That's right. And this bears directly on the issue of self-determination on the issue of right to die. In 1973, Dax Cort was 25 and suffered extensive burns throughout his body involving his eyes, and he had severe burns over 65% of his body. He was admitted to Parkland Hospital in Dallas, Texas, and his chance of survival there in a very excellent burn facility was estimated to be only 10%. He was in severe pain despite large doses of narcotics, and but he was still determined to have full decision-making capacity. And he said, "I want to die." And he actually expressed on multiple occasions, "I want to kill myself, I want to die." His mother, who actually did not have proxy or legal standing, prevailed. And she said, "Do everything you can to treat my son." And in fact, he did survive. And He won a lawsuit and was financially secure after that, went to Baylor Law School and practices law. Now, here's the hooker. He is still bitter, and his life mission right now is to advocate for people's right to die. And he still says that he wanted to die and he should have been allowed to die.
It's so interesting. He must be like 60, 61, 62
Whatever
years
it is,
old at this point.
Since 1973.
And he's been working on this right to die since then.
Right.
It's fascinating. And I imagine, too, there are stories that go in the other direction. Someone who didn't want to, and the family perhaps, you know, took them off a respirator, really realizing how desperate the situation was. And these are decisions that take place every day, aren't they, Pat?
Absolutely. And I think, as Dr. Eastwood and you have said, to talk more about that and to find the people, either ethics or palliative care, that's a lot of what we do, is help people assist and guide when you're trying to do decision making or goals of care. But the more you talk about these things and the less you feel uncomfortable about the fact that we are all going to die, the better I think that we're going to be able to have our rights and our needs met.
Absolutely. And I think that really is the key. We do have a right in America as individuals to make these decisions, and we can find the help around us. And certainly the ethics department at SUNY Upstate University Hospital, there are people who can be called in to help out.
Well, there is a full-fledged, robust ethics consult service at University Hospital that the ethics department or the Center for Bioethics and Humanities participates in. That's absolutely right.
And the palliative care, of course, which is ongoing every day in the hospital. And, you know, it's interesting to me, that's not a service that's found everywhere, is it?
That's correct. And we're very fortunate to have a wonderful service here at University. We've now been in action for 7 years. But you're right, it's not, and it's something that is growing more across the country. So we're fortunate.
Well, Pat Knox and Dr. Eastwood, thanks so much for joining us this morning. This has been a fascinating conversation. And listeners, we know you have additional questions. You may have stories to share. You may even want to suggest additional types of ethical conundrums that we can address in future shows. And we want to make it easy for you to do that. So at the end of this morning's show, we're going to provide you with ways to contact us by email, postal mail, and phone, so you too can participate in these conversations. And we do need to take a commercial break now. We'll be back shortly. This is SUNY Upstate's HealthLink on air on 570 WSYR.